The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I'm just delighted with my guest today. I want you to imagine that there's a place in the world far away where children are getting less stimulant medication than they used to. I want you to imagine that in this place far, far away, children are getting diagnosed less frequently with ADHD than they used to. For an instant, compare this to the USA, where the diagnosing and drugging of children with all sorts of diagnoses and drugs does nothing but go up, 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 and where the American Academy of Pediatrics, flush with drug company money, has now extended the allowable age to diagnose and drug these children to age 4. Imagine such a place. Fantasy? No. This place where the children are safer than they used to be from the predations of the pharmaceutical industry and my colleagues in medicine, pediatrics, and psychiatry is Western Australia, the Perth area of the world. Now, why in the world are things getting better in Australia, its western portion, and probably, as far as I know, nowhere else in the world? The answer is my guest, Martin Whiteley. Martin is a Labor member of the Western Australia Parliament, or, as it's called, the Legislative Assembly. He's been there since 2001, and he has made a campaign of discouraging the diagnosing and drugging of children. And he's also become an international figure in standing up on these issues. I'm proud to say that Martin came to our conference last year in Syracuse, New York, and did a marvelous presentation, and that it looks like he might be able to come to our forthcoming conference April 13th, 14th, and 15th in Syracuse this coming 2012. Martin, are you there from Australia?
Good afternoon there it is, Peter, isn't it?
I think it's evening here. It's after 5 o'clock here.
Right, yeah.
I panicked at the last moment and emailed you because I became afraid that maybe with the time change, you know, we fell backward an hour, that you wouldn't have it calculated right. But here you are.
Oh, we figured it out in the end.
Martin, just talk about what you're doing or anything else you want. I want a lot of this hour to just be you telling folks about what you're doing.
Well, I guess you gave a fairly good summary there, Peter. We are, to my knowledge, the only ADHD child drugging hotspot in the world that's seen a massive decline in child prescribing rates. Just to put some numbers around it, in 2002, the per head population of children drugged in Western Australia was just a little bit higher than the US national average, and by far and away the highest in Australia, about 3 to 4 times the rates in other parts of Australia. But we tightened up some, we put in place some very strong prescribing accountability measures. So the very heavy clinicians that used to prescribe very frequently and virtually did so without any need to be accountable for their prescribing patterns. We tightened up their accountability measures, and it forced some retirements. And Perth's a fairly small city. It's a city of the entire population of Western Australia is about 2.5 million, and it occupies an area four times the size of Texas. So we're talking about a very, very isolated city. And just getting to a handful of prescribers and enforcing a few retirements led to a massive decline in prescribing rates. We had a fall off of about 70% in prescribing rates. Now, the numbers in Western Australia of children on stimulants fell from about 18,000 to a little bit lower than 6,000. And it seems to have leveled out at that level for the last 3 or 4 years. It's been consistent around the 6,000 level, which concerns me still. I'd like to get it much lower. I don't think amphetamines are good for kids, and I don't think ADHD is a valid diagnosis. But nonetheless, it's heartening to have such a massive decline.
Marvelous work. What were these regulations that forced people to reduce their prescribing or even to quit and retire early?
Well, there have always been in Australia they're called Schedule 8 drugs. I think in America, is it Schedule 4 or Schedule 2? I'm not too sure.
Schedule 2.
Schedule 2.
The highest schedule possible for a non-experimental drug is Schedule 2, and that's where they are, along with morphine, along with the opiates.
Yeah, well, they always had the potential to be highly regulated because they have a high potential for abuse and diversion. But what was happening was the very heavy prescribers were getting exempted from the prescribing measures. They were assumed to be competent because they did it so often, and they were given this thing called block authorization, whereby they could prescribe as much as they like without having to be accountable for each individual script. So you had this absurd situation whereby you might have the odd psychiatrist or pediatrician who might prescribe to one or perhaps two children a year and had to jump through all sorts of hoops to do that, to prescribe to that one child. But if you prescribed to 1,500 or 2,000 children a year, you were assumed to know what you're doing, and there was no accountability there put in place at all. So what we did was we made every prescriber equally accountable, and for the first time we collected data about how much each clinician was prescribing. It wasn't identified, but to be honest, in a place as small as Perth, everybody knew who the very heavy prescribers were, and when we put the prescribing measures in place, we identified that one particular prescriber prescribed to over 2,000 children in 17 months. Now, everybody, was de-identified, but it's an open secret in Perth who that was, and fortunately, as I said, there were some retirements that were sort of semi-voluntary, you might say, and when those people retired from prescribing, there was a massive decline in child prescribing rates.
Now, of course, that must have led to a lot of crime and violence on unmedicated children who needed their drugs, or, in fact, did the world go on as before without drugging the kids?
Well, actually, it was one of the consequences were that Western Australia used to have very high rates of amphetamine abuse amongst teenagers. But when we had this massive decline in child prescribing rates, we had a 50% fall in teenage amphetamine abuse rates. So, and they did some, they buried deeper into this, and they found out when they did some statistical analysis that 5 out of 6 kids that had abused amphetamines in Western Australia had actually abused prescription amphetamines, either dexamphetamine or Ritalin. And when they dried up the supply of the free divertible supply of medicinal amphetamines, there was a massive decline in child or teenage abuse rates of amphetamines. So it sort of supported that very common sense proposition that if you stop giving kids free amphetamines, they'll stop abusing them.
That is incredible information. Love to have you write that up, however briefly, for our newsletter. I think that's very important information. Have you been able to track the corresponding use or abuse, really, always, of cocaine? Because we know now that these drugs predispose children and youth to abuse cocaine when they become young adults.
Yeah, look, I haven't actually done that. I mean, the amphetamines is a far more common abuse problem in Australia, and I'd suggest one of the reasons is because of abuse of diverted prescription amphetamines. But I'm not as familiar with the statistics for cocaine. However, they do track by state, comparing Western Australia to the other Australian states. They do track the rates of abuse of a whole range of drugs, and in 7 out of 8 categories, Western Australia was higher than the national average. So for marijuana, for a whole range of drugs, Western Australia was above the national average. Now, this was when we had the highest prescribing rates of ADHD drugs, which was supposed to. The theory was that, you know, by prescribing ADHD drugs, you prevented drug abuse, but the evidence all points the other way. It's not as direct evidence as that massive fall in amphetamine abuse rates, but nonetheless, when we had the highest prescribing rates of prescription amphetamines for ADHD, we also had the highest rates in Australia of drug abuse in 7 out of 8 categories.
Well, that really is very responsive to my question. Martin, you're doing such incredibly important work. I just want to take a second and just tell you how much many of us here in America and around the world appreciate, you know, what you're doing. You have a book you've written, and would you identify early on now in the show that what you've written and how people can get in touch with you?
Well, I've got a website, Speed Up and Sit Still. The name of the book is Speed Up and Sit Still, and it's largely the story of ADHD in Australia, and particularly Western Australia. But you can't talk about ADHD in Australia without talking about ADHD in America. And really, to be honest, it's an imported epidemic. I mean, Australia has slavishly followed the DSM model, and I think that's been at our cost, and now there's some backlash against that, I'm pleased to say, and people are starting to question whether that's the way to go. But the book is called Speed Up and Sit Still. I've got a website, Speed Up, and www.speedupsitstill. If you just Google Speed Up and Sit Still, you'll find it. And the book's available on the website, but also there's lots of information about the story of ADHD in Australia, but also around the world, and hopefully it helps to debunk some of the pseudoscience that's put out there to support the wholesale drugging of children around the world, which I think is an absolute disgrace.
Yeah, it's one of the most disturbing things in my life is this issue of millions of children, often our best and our brightest, our most rebellious and independent, our most spirited, and that we are humiliating them and setting them back with diagnoses and then literally injuring their brains. These drugs, we have studies showing they cause atrophy, studies showing they cause persistent biochemical changes, studies showing they make children prone to drug abuse, just as you found out in your own part of the world. And they discourage children from thinking they can control their lives. They suppress the natural impulse of the child to grow, to prosper, to take charge of his or her own life. I'm just so glad that you are doing this kind of work. I wish we had a legislator in the United States that was as devoted and informed as you.
Yeah, it's interesting because the whole thing is built on a presumption that if you don't, it's built on this sort of panic that panics parents into saying if you don't medicate your child's going to suffer future academic failure. And it's really interesting, Peter, because we had this study in Western Australia that started in 1989, which is about when the ADHD epidemic kicked off over here. And it followed a cohort of children that were born in 1989, and it now has followed them all the way through to their 21 years of age. It's a generalised health study, started following 3,000 children, and it measured their mother's characteristics and health pre-birth all the way through. You know, and it's measured at every, when they were born, when they were 1, when they were 3, when they were 5, all the way through to age 20, 21. And because in that generation we had such high rates of prescribing of ADHD, there were, in that group, there were a cohort of 130 children who had been diagnosed ADHD by the time they'd turned 14. And they actually followed the progress of these kids And of the 130, about 30 had never been medicated, so they'd never been put on, they'd diagnosed ADHD and had never been put on ADHD drugs. And the other 100 had either been put on them and were still on them, or had been put on them and come off them. And what they found when they did a comparison was the kids that were ADHD and medicated were 10.5 times more likely to be rated by their classroom teacher as failing school than the kids that were ADHD and unmedicated. Now, that originally, when that those results came out, some of the ADHD enthusiasts in Australia tried to justify it by saying, oh, well, of course, the more severely disabled kids, the kids with the worst ADHD, were the ones that were medicated. But when they dug into it and they went back and had a look at age five, when none of these kids were medicated, there was absolutely no difference in symptoms. So the only observable difference, the only was some were medicated and some were unmedicated. And the kids that were unmedicated were doing far, far better at school than the kids that were medicated. Now, and I think that goes to the very heart of the whole ADHD lie, and that is that this idea that somehow the amphetamines, the ADHD drugs, work differently on children that have ADHD, but all they simply do is they narrow focus. So, you know, you can argue they're a temporary performance enhancer. I think they probably crush creativity and make kids perform in a very narrow range of tasks. But when you look at the long term, all they seem to appear to do is fry brains. And so not only was there this massive increased chance of failing school for the kids that were medicated, but they also had higher diastolic blood pressure. Even the kids that had been put on the drugs and taken off the drugs still had this residual effect. So, you know, there were two. The long-term effects that came out of this study were, one, you were 10.5 times more likely to be failing school if you were medicated, and two, that you had a lasting residual effect on diastolic blood pressure, which sets you up for all sorts of adverse effects later in life. So the whole myth of ADHD is built around this fear of long-term academic failure. But the evidence that came out of Western Australia, and there isn't, you know, as you know, Peter, there's not a lot of systematic long-term evidence collected around these drugs, and I suspect the reason for that is they just simply don't want to know what they really do. But the long-term evidence coming out of WA was that it leads to academic failure and you know, problems with heart conditions later in life.
There's no way around it. Common sense prevails. You know, help keep our kids off speed. I mean, it's just common sense, but psychiatry overwhelms common sense again and again and again. You know, Martin, we're finding this now in every area that's examined. Patients who are diagnosed with psychotic disorders do far better if they have less medication or no medication in the long run. Patients taking antidepressants become chronic depressives. We have more and more evidence for that. And by so-called bipolar disorder, the numbers are just increasing hugely during this splurging of medication. And we've taken a disorder that used to be thought of as episodic with no deterioration, and we now have all these patients labeled bipolar who are deteriorating very badly over time. So, and now we're looking at the stimulants, and we also know the same thing with the benzodiazepines, the sedatives and so-called anxiolytics. So in every area that we're examining over the years now, drugs, hey, big surprise, are not good for the brain, therefore not good for the mind, and actually harm people in the long run, and very dramatically and very drastically, often with documented brain damage in animal studies and some human studies across the whole range of these drugs. But the saddest of all is what we're doing to our kids. Was there in the area of Western Australia and Perth, was there also the giving, as we've had here, of these all these other drugs, declaring these kids bipolar and giving them a whole range of drugs?
We've managed to largely escape the sort of juvenile bipolar epidemic, thankfully. But there was a lot of was polypharmacy, where kids were medicated for ADHD, or so-called medicated for ADHD, and they then developed all sorts of side effects, you know, the typical problems with sleep, and they were given a range of other drugs to manage the side effects of the radiation.
Well, they get depressed, so they give them antidepressants.
Yeah.
It's very depressing drugs.
Yeah, and in fact, there was a facility that isn't as used, thankfully, I guess because of some of the success we've had, that was actually set up specifically to detox kids on prescription medications. And these kids had come on a range of prescription medications, you know, of sleeping pills, ADHD medications, antidepressants. And the first thing they'd do was actually try and put these kids in a residential program and actually detoxify them. And then they'd start to work with the families. And they found that when they worked with the families, there were complex things going on at home. And if the families were prepared to work with them, the majority of these kids were able to come off all medications. So ADHD drugs were the major, and I'm aware of the massive growth in the use of drugs for bipolar disorder in America, but it hasn't been, fortunately, as common here.
You know, what you're describing, you know, as a psychiatrist, just totally confirms my clinical experience, which is if the family is willing to be responsible and to work with me, any child can be helped without the use of psychiatric drugs. It all depends on the family. These are children. It's our responsibility as adults, as teachers, and in your case, as a member of parliament, to see that our kids get the proper resources, not drugs, but human beings, parents, teachers, ministers, coaches, to help them. The work you're doing is the work of a saint, Martin. I don't exaggerate.
Well, thank you.
You know, just go ahead and talk a little bit more. We've got another 8 minutes or so before break. Tell us maybe something about how you got started in this whole area.
Well, before I became a politician, I was a teacher, a high school teacher. And I taught at a school that was in a very affluent area, a very wealthy area, and it had it was a boys' school. It was exclusively a boys' school, single-sex school, but it had very good school. No problems there, but it had very high rates of prescribing of ADHD medication, and it was down to that one clinician. Frankly, he lived in that local area and was servicing that area. And I saw his handiwork up front. And initially, I sort of had these boys in... I'd never heard of ADHD, to be honest. And then about 1995, I had a number of boys in my class that were very heavily medicated. And I was told, I was given the professional development training that said these boys have a biochemical brain imbalance called ADHD, and they can't function without their drugs. And I looked at these kids, and they were sitting in class, 14, 15-year-old boys, and they were just so unnaturally compliant. I mean, I don't expect 14, 15-year-old boys to be angels. I mean, I think it is natural for boys to be boisterous and boys to be a bit mischievous and, talk. You know, I think it's expected that kids get a bit off the rails when they turn 14. And yet these boys that were supposedly unwell were sitting in class, heavily medicated, very compliant, so in that respect very easy to control in the classroom, but their academic performance was also very, very ordinary. So I thought, these kids don't seem to be benefiting from this, and all I can see is that they've lost their life spark. So I became interested in it and slowly educated myself about the condition. In fact, the first thing I did was read one of the very first things I did, Peter, was read Talking Back to Ritalin, which really opened my eyes to what was going on, and in many ways became the foundation of much of my work. So thank you very much for what you did there, and it really did have an effect on the other side of the globe. You can't get much further away from the east coast of America than the west coast of Australia, but your work had an enormous effect, because it actually gave me, after all, I'm simply a teacher turned politician without any psychiatric training, but it gave me an intellectual basis for starting to take up this fight. And then I got elected to Parliament, and of course things became a lot easier for me, because you get a voice when you're in public office, and I decided to try and use that voice to address this issue. We've had some success.
Well, you know, it practically, I mean, literally practically brings tears to my eyes that my book has had that effect on you and hence on Australia, because it's been so frustrating in the United States of America and North America and Europe. I just feel sometimes at my wit's end as I see generations of children being intoxicated on these whole range of drugs, and I feel so unable to do anything about it. So it's a great encouragement to me that to hear that I've had that effect through you, and just amazing what you're doing. Martin, have you been in a position as a parliamentarian to look into the influence of the drug companies on any of these individual doctors or on Australia?
The truth is that we have imported most of our science from America. So doctors like Dr. Biederman were as influential in Australia as they were in America. So the drug company connections that have affected clinical practice in America have also affected it in Australia. But one of the things that we have had here is very powerful patient support groups. We've got a group called LADS in Western Australia, which is the equivalent of CHAD in the US, that takes money from the pharmaceutical industry. Now, I don't suggest these people are corrupt. I think they actually believe that they're doing wonderful work and they're helping people. But nonetheless, they are incredibly enthusiastic about the use of drugs, and they take money from the pharmaceutical industry. And they've been incredibly vocal and incredibly well organised. And this is one of the great problems we've got when it comes to winning the hearts and minds of the public and winning getting in the ears of legislators, etc. It's a very unfair fight because you've got the might of the pharmaceutical industry with all its dollars and all its professionalism fighting individuals that really don't have an economic base. I mean, it's very hard for people, for psychiatrists, and this is where you deserve great credit, to actually make a living not diagnosing a condition. It's very hard to actually go out there and become expert in something that you can't make a living from. Now, what has happened in Australia, and it's still the case that ADHD rates of prescribing are rising in states other than Australia. There is one other state, South Australia, which has had a modest falling off, and that was down to the advocacy of one very determined and prominent psychiatrist in South Australia who deserves great credit, John Girardini. But elsewhere in Australia, rates of prescribing are increasing, and it's largely because the ADHD industry, and they are an industry, are very, very well organised and very, very well resourced. It's very difficult for people like yourself and people even like myself to actually compete against such a highly resourced resourced and frankly unethical industry that really tries to make normal childhood into a psychiatric disorder. So we have had individual influence on doctors, and they do get supported by the pharmaceutical industry. But the truth is, most of the science that we rely on has been imported from the States.
In that regard, for folks who don't know who Joseph Biederman is, you mentioned him. It's Biederman. He's a Harvard professor. He, for a long time, has taken a lot of money from the drug companies and has done their bidding, literally done their bidding of spreading the diagnosing down to children and, in particular, pushing bipolar disorder from his bully puppet as a Harvard professor and head of their child pharmacology section. I blew the whistle on Biederman many, many years ago and had the honor of being on the same panel with him. I was the scientific expert on adverse drug effects at the Federal Consensus Conference more than a decade ago. on ADHD and Ritalin, ADHD and stimulants, and I talked about their adverse effects, and he was boasting about how harmless they were. And he and I got into a little discussion of the science. He brought up his latest paper. I demolished his latest paper, and the chair had to intervene to protect poor Dr. Biederman. They have nothing, nothing whatsoever going for them except the power of drug company money and the gullibility of human beings looking for simpler solutions than exist. We can go to break in a minute or two whenever the music starts. In the meanwhile, Martin Whiteley, thank you so much for this first half hour. When we come back, perhaps you can tell us a little more personally about yourself and talk about anything you like.
Thank you. Absolutely.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, the conscience of psychiatry, with my marvelous guest, Martin Whiteley, W-H-I-T-E-L-Y. If you just Google his name, Martin Whiteley, you'll find him. I want to take a brief minute and just talk about this diagnosis of ADHD so that we can dismiss this monster once and for all. As my colleague and friend Fred Bauman, neurologist from San Diego, has pointed out again and again, and as I've been saying for years, it simply isn't a medical syndrome. The three categories that you can pick from are hyperactivity, inattention, and impulsivity. And all of the behaviors are pretty much tailored to things that require attention in a classroom. Not paying attention to details, losing things, talking out of turn. Literally, this is what the diagnosis consists of in the official manual, interrupting the teacher and so on. Getting out of your chair, climbing when you're not supposed to climb. I mean, it's just a list of things that in a classroom a teacher who isn't really thinking about what he or she is doing would like to snuff out. And this list can't be biological in origin. It can't be a medical syndrome because it can be anything. What might make a child act in an out-of-control manner, a manner where they're not focusing, where they're inattentive or impulsive or hyperactive? Well, it could be the kid's normal, because every one of these things is normal. Could be the kid's bored in the classroom. Could be the kid hasn't been taught properly, so he can't read and is upset in the classroom. Could be the teacher doesn't know how to teach. Could be mom and dad, and this is the most common thing I see, in addition to boring classrooms, mom and dad haven't gotten their act together to learn to just discipline an ordinary or a particularly wonderful and rambunctious child. Mom and dad need some parent training or some family work, as Martin pointed out earlier. So it could be the child does have something physically wrong. We have a lot of kids getting concussions in the way we play ball nowadays. We have kids going to school and practically malnourished. We have kids with, you know, in homes that are broken, homes that are conflicted, and that'll send a kid to school unable to concentrate very well. Could even be an underlying disorder like diabetes. Most of the children that I see in my kind of a practice, which is, you know, middle class to better, but some poor folks, most of them just have families where they're not learning to be disciplined, and then they're going to schools that aren't capturing their imagination. One of my patients just was talking to me about visiting the classroom of one of her kids, and she just couldn't believe how boring it was. So you can't have a valid medical disorder when you have a hodgepodge of disconnected, broad categories that could subsume almost anything on the face of the earth. In my experience, the kids are really very normal who get this diagnosis. They're just having trouble in their environments, having conflict, and it's because either the school isn't meeting their needs or the family isn't meeting their needs. And now, why do the drugs work? Why do the stimulants work? You know, drugs like Adderall and Dexedrine, which are amphetamines, drugs that are amphetamine-like, which are the, you know, Ritalin and Concerta and Focalin, which are these methylphenidate drugs. You know, why do they work? Well, we know from animals that they work, animal studies, by suppressing all spontaneous behavior and enforcing obsessive behavior. Literally, that's what they do to the chimp. So the chimp now, instead of wanting to get free and escape and play with its mates and smile and poke like they do and get their little hierarchy systems, very much like children, the chimps now lose their socialization desires and skills. Instead of grooming, they pick at their own skin. Instead of trying to escape, they gnaw on bars. They become good caged chimps by crushing spontaneity and enforcing obsessive behavior. And that over-focusing that Martin was talking about, that's an aspect of the obsessiveness that it causes in the children. Meanwhile, all the studies show, and this has been going on for now decades, that there's no improvement in any measurable aspect of being a child, from grades to socialization to happiness. And we're getting more and more evidence that the children are simply harmed. Wanted to get in that little description of the science behind this that you can find in my books, and including my heavy science book, Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry. And you can find it in Martin Whiteley's work as well. So come back, my guest, and now you talk for a time.
Yeah, look, it's interesting, Peter. Everything that you say is there true, but it's also really concerning that what they've got proposed for ADHD and DSM-5. They've actually added another four ways to display ADHD. I'll just go through them quickly. That tends to act without thinking, is often impatient. The third one is uncomfortable doing things slowly and systematically. And the fourth one finds it difficult to resist temptations or opportunities. I mean, I just think that highlights how absurd it is. And they've, not only have they added another three ways, or four ways to display ADHD, so there's now 22 different ways to display it, they've actually made the bar even lower because they've taken it for anybody 17 years of age or older, instead of having to display six of either the inattentive or six of the impulsive hyperactive behaviours, you can now display four. So you can display as few as four out of 22 of these behaviours and get diagnosed. Now, if you go back to DSM-3, that was published in 1980, you used to have to display 12 out of 18. So progressively, there's been this lowering of the bar. I mean, you went through the diagnostic criteria, things like losing your toys and pencils, and my favourite of all time is the one avoiding or disliking homework. I mean, who doesn't avoid or dislike homework? Why isn't that normal behaviour? But you used to have to display, as I said, 12 out of the 18. Now it's as low as 4 out of 22. And we've seen this progressive lowering of the bar through DSM-3, through to DSM-4, and now what's proposed for DSM-5. But there is actually some good news. I mean, it's not all bad news. I think things have got so absurd that some within the mainstream of psychiatry, some of with the psychiatric establishment are now starting to say, what are we doing? And we've gone far too far. So it's, you know, it's not just brave souls like yourself that are sort of leading the charge anymore. It's really encouraging to hear people like Dr. Ellen Francis, who was the lead author of DSM-4, and I'm a fierce critic of DSM-4. I think it's full of rubbish, and I think it's done a lot of harm. But Dr. Ellen Francis has actually been honest enough to say, look, we did some things in DSM-4 which had some very unforeseen and nasty consequences. We, you know, it was DSM-4 that helped to trigger the explosion in ADHD prescribing. It was DSM-4 that helped to trigger a massive growth in autism diagnosis. It was DSM-4 that led to this epidemic of bipolar in children. And he's saying enough's enough. We need to go back. Instead of expanding and adding new psychiatric disorders in DSM-5, we need to be looking at what we did in DSM-4 and winding it back. So whilst that doesn't go as far as you and I would both like, whilst I think the whole fundamental basis of having behaviours as being used as evidence of biochemical brain imbalances is a nonsense, it's really encouraging to hear people like Dr. Ellen Francis, who was, you know, frankly, from the apps, you couldn't get more mainstream than the chief author of DSM-4 coming out and saying, we've got this wrong and we need to fix it. And there is a worldwide backlash that's happening as well. The British Psychological Association and now some chapters of the American Psychological Association have started an online petition saying, hold on, what's proposed for DSM-5 is absurd. And I can actually see a time coming when the DSM won't be the dominant. It'll be so discredited that it won't be the dominant Bible of psychiatry, as it's called, as people frequently call it. It won't have that dominant position. I think the American Psychiatric Association is losing its grip on mainstream psychiatry, and it's wonderful to hear some strong voices from within the psychiatric establishment start to take it on and start to recognise that things have been running far too fast in the wrong direction.
First, thank you for that really up-to-date analysis. My main concern is, as much as I appreciate what Dr. Francis is doing, he's not dealing with the fundamental issue that this diagnosing process is wrong and this drugging process is wrong. So while he'll have a hopefully salutary effect, it's more of the effect of a pendulum swing. We'll go up, we'll go down, maybe, hopefully we'll go down. But he ultimately empowers the system by making very clear that he is not criticizing the fundamentals of diagnosing and drugging. But I do think it's a good sign, just as the American Academy of Pediatrics is a bad sign wanting to reduce it down to age 4. The real problem is getting anyone in the field of psychiatry to say something like I've been saying for decades, specifically about children, that there are always better alternatives to diagnosing and drugging children. Always better alternatives. And those alternatives lie in the hands of the adults who are caring for that child, the parents, the babysitters, the teachers and ministers, the culture itself, that we really need to go back to the traditional concept that children are not our property to be disposed of, you know. We hold them in trust, and we're supposed to treasure them, protect their brains, protect them from abuse. And psychiatry is perpetrating in medicine child abuse with this massive diagnosing and drugging. But I really appreciate your analysis. I'm more cynical about the effects of people like Dr. Francis who aren't going to reject the system but just want to make it a little better.
I guess it's because I'm a politician.
that you
operate in the world of the achievable. I mean, even in Western Australia, I mean, I've frankly, Peter, there are 6,000, just under 6,000 kids on ADHD medications in Western Australia. I wish there was, you know, under 100. I wish that, you know, the only kids that got amphetamines were perhaps those that have narcolepsy, you know, the traditional use, or it was used in extremely short-term situations where, you know, some kid's so out of control, or nobody got it. You know, that's frankly would be my ideal. I think the world would be a better place if nobody had ever invented ADHD drugs. But, and, you know, frankly, it's somewhat, I'm aiming for two aims here. I agree with you that if we can get to a world where kids' needs are really identified without the use of drugs, it'd be a much better place. And I think mental health outcomes would be a lot better without this reliance on, without, you know, children, frankly, being using psychiatric drugs. However, as I said, if you can swing the pendulum back the other way and less kids are harmed, that's a good thing. And I am encouraged in the sense that I think for the first time there's some voices that are prepared to foster a real debate about where psychiatry should be headed. Now, it could things could go very badly and things could get even worse. And there are some real concerns in Australia at the moment with the dominance of some influencers who are trying to push us, in my view, to a away from the DSM-5, but to a new frightening area of pre-psychotic drugging. I don't know if you've heard of the works of Professor Patrick McGorry.
Yes, of course. Tell our audience about it. This is incredibly important. This is a disaster.
Yeah, Patrick McGorry is a very high profile psychiatrist. He won the 2010 Australian of the Year award.
But by the way, Martin, the best in psychiatry is always the worst. They're always the most fascistic, the most domineering, the most authoritarian. Those are the ones that, like Biederman, who are always being the best doc.
Yeah.
But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Look, I think Biederman, frankly, is a different class altogether. I think Biederman took money, and from what I can understand about the man, that was his motivation. I actually think Patrick McGorry is somebody who genuinely believes he's doing good. But he's come up with this theory of prodromal mental illness that you can spot people that are about to become mentally ill. And the most famous of the ones that he's been involved with was pre-psychosis, spotting people that are about to become psychotic. And one of the big arguments about DSM-5 is whether it include psychosis risk syndrome or attenuated psychotic disorder in DSM-5. And this is this idea that you can spot people who are about to become psychotic. Now, in the past, Patrick McGorry has advocated that psychosis risk syndrome should be put in DSM-5. He's also advocated the use of antipsychotics as a measure of, as a way of preventing future psychosis. And he's also experimented with the use of antipsychotics. Now, he's actually, because there's been a vigorous debate about this in Australia, he's actually pulled back from those three positions, and he doesn't publicly advocate psychosis risk syndrome to be included in DSM-5 anymore, and he doesn't publicly advocate the use of antipsychotics as a preventative measure. But nonetheless, this is typical of his approach, which is that you can recognise people before they become mentally ill, and you can put them on low doses of whatever illness it is, whatever drugs associated with whatever illness it is that you're trying to prevent, and that's supposed to be a good thing. For instance, one of his allies, a Dr. Ian Hickey, is involved in a study with the use of fish oil and low-level antidepressants in elderly people as a measure of preventing elderly depression. So these are people that have got there's no indication that they're going to go on and become depressed, but because there's a problem, a perceived problem with, you know, elder people becoming depressed, he believes that we should be experimenting with the use of antidepressants in low doses as a measure of preventing that. Now, I find that incredibly frightening, because not only do we have to fight this current situation whereby you are trying to prevent these frankly absurd diagnoses that are so loose, and people being, you know, put on these labels with them, you've actually got this situation now where we're fighting people who are trying to drug people as a measure of preventing them going on and becoming mentally ill. So that's a really vigorous debate that's kicked off in Australia. And of course, I don't, you know, think I've met Patrick McGorry. He's a very likeable man, and I think he's got a good heart. But nonetheless, I think his enthusiasm for what he believes in represents a danger to the to people, and it's so typical of what you've seen in psychiatry, and you know, for many decades, and you know, I've switched on to, and that is that psychiatry is always getting ahead of itself. It's always pretending that it understands so much more than it actually does. It's always hypothesising new approaches, and then practice runs ahead of the evidence. And we see all of these harms that are done. It's happened time and time again, and my concern is that there's a potential for it to happen again. But nonetheless, one thing that is happening is that there is an energised debate. It's now become a mainstream debate, at least in Australia, and I think it's ripe for another way forward, a way forward that, you know, where people realise that, you know, drugs are just a short-term band-aid solution at best. At worst, they do enormous harm. And if you really want to help people with mental health problems, you have to bury down to what's causing the problems and you know, go through this process of trial and error and try and match solutions to problems to the individual's problems. And that's difficult. It's expensive in the short term for governments because they don't have an easy answer that drugs provide. They can't just subsidise drugs and say we've done something. It actually is expensive in the short term, but in the long term it's the only thing that's going to deliver value for money. And changing that mindset is very difficult, but we're starting, hopefully in Australia, to have a more vigorous debate around these sorts of issues. And I think some of the noises I've been hearing out of the US means that it's perhaps more fertile for having those sorts of arguments in the US as well. Now, I appreciate all the concerns you had about Dr. Alan Francis and how you're basically trying to fix a flawed model. But nonetheless, I think there's an appetite for debate there that I haven't seen before.
Well, I think that's true. We are having more debate now. But I'm concerned that we're going to be moving increasingly to the edges of the debate, which is a little medication versus a lot of medication, giving it before they get sick or giving it after they get sick. So I'm kind of, you know, doing my best to try to hold this people's feet to the fire and to face the fact that this is not a system that you just tinker with and make a little better. It's a fundamentally harmful, flawed system. But God, I appreciate, you know, every single thing you're doing. I think you're just incredible. Have you met anyone else in the political arena who is standing beside you on these issues?
Look, at a local level, there were some. I was able to progress the tighter regulations around ADHD because the health minister at the time had been a former policeman and he'd seen the problems of amphetamine diversion, of prescription amphetamines being diverted.
That makes sense, yeah.
He was very, very supportive, and also the leaders of the premiers of my state, like the state governors, the equivalent of your state governors, have been particularly supportive.
Wonderful.
I think in the only person that I'm aware of that's actually had an effect in America was the Republican Senator Charles Grassley.
Yes, he's still working on a variety of issues.
He helped to expose the issues around Dr. Joseph Biederman and his undisclosed drug company payments, and that actually had a massive effect in Australia as well, because we at the time were redeveloping our national ADHD guidelines, and the most frequently cited expert in the draft guidelines was Dr. Biederman.
Wonderful.
And when Biederman's, you know, undisclosed payments, I think it was $1.6 million over a period of about 4 or 5 years, got disclosed.
Martin, we're coming to the end now. This has been a wonderful discussion. Martin Whiteley, just plug that into Google. Any 10-second goodbye you'd like to make, sir?
Oh, look, just to thank you for the work you're doing, Peter. I think it's really important to tackle this on every level. I mean, just exposing the fraud for what it is incredibly important. And I try to work on that level, but I also try to work on that level of politics where you try to achieve the achievable as well. So it's a very difficult fight, and you've done a marvellous job over many decades. So thank you from down under for all the fantastic work you've done. And it has made a difference down here, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Martin Whiteley. And thank you for listening to this show. This is a show of huge importance. To hear what Martin Whiteley has to say, pass it on to your friends. Make sure this show gets listened to. Goodbye now.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.